Hello everyone, and thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Elizabeth Kerr from Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. Today, we'll be talking about the potential for a government shutdown this week and what the coming debate over federal spending means for the broader economy. Joining us is Jacob Liebenloft. He's the Senior Advisor at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and also the former Deputy Director of the National Economic Council. For those of you who are new to Business Forward and new to our programming, we organize local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across America. And at these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives brief policymakers on issues affecting their businesses and how Washington can work with businesses to accelerate the economy. To date, more than 550 senior administration officials, members of Congress, governors, and mayors have participated in our programming. And this is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I need to cover just a few housekeeping items. First, this call is on the record, and that means that reporters may be present, but we're also recording this call. In our follow-up email after the call, we'll send you that recording as a podcast. Please feel free to share the recording with anyone who wasn't able to participate today. That link will also show you where you can download past Business Forward conference calls. Finally, there will be time for you to ask questions and share your advice after Jacob's remarks. You can do this in one of two ways. You can press 1 on your telephone keypad to ask a question live, or you can email your question to info@businessfwd.org. If I call on you live to ask a question, please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. So again, to ask a question, press 1 at any time on your telephone keypad and we'll enter you into the live queue, or you can email your question to us at info@businessfwd.org and I will read it aloud for you. And if you email that question, also please include your company name and location. So with that, let's get started. Please welcome Jacob Liebenloft.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for joining. I want to be brief so that we have a lot of time for questions, but I wanted to start by giving a brief update on the state of play this week in Washington, and then also give a feel for some of the broader dynamics at play as we look at some of the coming fights over the federal budget. As many of you know, the continuing resolution that funds the government expires at midnight this Friday, April 28th. At that point, if Congress does not pass a funding bill providing for appropriations, the government would shut down. And just as a reminder, I know many people may remember the shutdown in the fall of 2013, but the funding at issue here is the money that is annually appropriated each year by Congress. So a large portion of the federal budget obviously is mandatory payments, things like Social Security, Medicare, and so on. That would continue, but much of the government on both the domestic and defense side needs to be appropriated by Congress, and that appropriation expires on April 28th. So we're currently in a bit of an unusual circumstance, which is that we're seeing some hiccups, at least, in passing a funding bill, even though the same party controls the White House and both houses of Congress. In part, that's due to some potential disagreements between the White House and Republicans in Congress. It also relates to the fact that Democratic votes are likely needed to pass a bill in both houses of Congress. In the Senate, because 60 votes are needed to overcome a filibuster, and in the House, because some of the more conservative Republicans might refuse to vote even for a Republican leadership-endorsed bill requiring potential Democratic votes for passage. And so what we see right now as we look towards Friday is the potential for three sticking points to gum up the works a little bit. The first is that the White House and President Trump has expressed a desire for funding for a border wall. Obviously, this was a major part of President Trump's platform during the campaign and part of what he asked for in his so-called skinny budget released last month. Democrats, unsurprisingly, have made clear that they find funding for such a border wall to be unacceptable as part of a funding deal. The good news is that it appears, based on recent news reports, that the president maybe backing off somewhat from this demand, which would at least ease some of the disagreements that might block a bill from being passed. The second issue relates to the president's threats to sabotage the Affordable Care Act by withholding payments that reimburse insurers for so-called cost-sharing reductions. These are payments that come from the federal government and make it possible for insurers to keep down deductibles and coinsurance without premium spiking. As a reminder, House Republicans have filed a lawsuit that argued that the administration, at this point when they filed it, it was the Obama administration, lacked the authority to make these payments. And an easy solution would be that the Trump administration could continue to make these payments while it defends the lawsuit, as the prior administration does. And most legal experts think that the administration would, that either administration, the Obama administration or the Trump administration, would win in court. But President Trump has threatened to stop defending the lawsuit and withhold these cost-sharing reduction payments, essentially taking them hostage to try to force action on an ACA repeal bill. That has meant that not only Democrats, but many insurers and, in fact, the broader business community have asked for the administration and Congress to provide some clarification, including clarifying language on an appropriations bill around CSRs, which would not require any new money but would provide needed certainty. So this is, again, a major sticking point right here with an opportunity, if it's resolved, to allow for passage of a bill. The final major issue is that there are several so-called policy riders under dispute. These riders are provisions that are attached to spending bills that don't change spending levels, but specify that the federal government must enact a particular policy or alternatively can't take a particular action. We lack a lot of details right now in this close hold negotiation as to exactly what is happening around these riders, but in recent years, Democrats have expressed objections to problematic policy riders that Republicans have tried to attach to so-called must-pass legislation like these funding bills. So these are sort of the three big issues we see right now that remain the sticking points in negotiations. I think most of us who are watching closely are hopeful that these can be resolved. There's a chance that they might not be resolved by Friday, in which case the most likely outcome would be a short-term continuing resolution of a few days, which would essentially extend the deadline for Congress to pass a full omnibus appropriations bill. But again, our hope right now is that while these issues are significant, that they can be resolved in a bipartisan way. However, the most important dynamic, I think, right here is that the administration in particular needs to be clear that they're not going to continue to use the appropriations process as an opportunity to drive some of the more controversial and problematic policy goals like building a wall or undermining the ACA. So we can talk about some of those dynamics further as questions arise, and we can also talk about why a government shutdown would be problematic, including some of the lessons we learned out of the 2013 shutdown, which I remember well because I was at the National Economic Council at the White House at the time. But I think the other thing I'd like to mention is that even when this debate over funding the government through the rest of fiscal year 2017, so through the end of September, is resolved, we have a lot of very significant debates over our fiscal future going forward and over government spending. As I mentioned last month, the administration released its so-called skinny budget. That document only dealt with this discretionary side of the budget, that part, again, that's appropriated every year, but it gave some indications of the fiscal priorities of the administration. In particular, it proposed to cut non-defense discretionary funding by $54 billion in fiscal year 2018, so in the next fiscal year, and that's already below, some already really problematic funding levels as a result of sequestration. So the administration would cut the non-defense side by $54 billion, shift that funding to defense spending. And to do that, it would require cutting domestic programs outside of vets and homeland security by about 15% below current levels and by about 30% below 2010 levels. So we're talking about major cuts to really core programs on the domestic side of the budget. And these include some of the most significant programs for individuals and communities that the president has promised to help, areas like job training, student aid and work study programs that help low and moderate income students afford college, or economic development funding for both cities and rural communities. It includes cuts to areas of the budget that help grow our economy in both the short term and long term, like research and development funding, clean energy, or support for manufacturing and small business. And these proposed cuts in many ways go against a bipartisan consensus we began to see over the last couple of years of the Obama administration, which was that funding for the discretionary side of the budget was already too low as a result of sequestration. That's the start of the Trump administration's fiscal agenda, but it's really a preview of what we might see when the administration puts out its full budget, which is expected in mid to late May. There's a lot we don't know about what will be in that budget, including what deficit targets the administration might try to hit, how much detail they might put forward on a tax plan, or what they might cut in other parts of the budget. But based on what the president has suggested during the campaign, we can likely expect, in addition to the discretionary cuts I described, large tax cuts that most likely will disproportionately benefit the wealthy, combined with deep cuts to so-called mandatory programs like Medicaid or the SNAP program. And we've seen a preview of this dynamic before in past congressional Republican budgets, and it's really the dynamic we see in the House Republican health care bill as well. We see significant tax breaks in that bill that are paid for effectively by cuts in healthcare coverage. So as we look towards the budget resolution for 2018, so next year's budget resolution, we'll likely see some of these core fiscal goals become the center of a debate, which will both raise some questions about what happens with government spending, but also what might be possible around a potential tax reform bill. And so I think it's important to understand that beyond the immediate of this week, we're entering this period where we're going to see repeated discussions over what direction the federal budget should go in, both from a broad perspective, like what our deficit level should be, and on a program-by-program level. And I think these are debates where it's going to be really important to hear from the business community. We are, as I mentioned, already in an era of historically low domestic discretionary spending. And when that puts pressure on programs that support areas like R&D, like job training, like support for small business and manufacturers, that creates the potential risk of weakening our economy, as do broader cuts that put the health and well-being of our nation and its workforce at risk. I think in the past we've seen, in my experience from when I was in the administration, was that the business community can be a really important voice in conveying the need for these investments, and I expect that will be really important going forward as these critical debates occur. But with that in mind, I want to open things up to questions so we can talk about either what's happening this week or what we expect going forward.
Great, thank you. We've got a few email questions that we're going to start with. The first one here is, you mentioned policy riders. What are the policy riders that they're trying to add in, and why is that even allowed in a spending bill?
So the answer to the first question, and this is where it's a little bit different when you're on the outside than in the administration, is there's been very little information released publicly about what policy riders are under discussion. In the past, we've seen Republicans try to attach riders that, for example, prevent an administration from enacting certain environmental or labor regulations. So You might see that, you know, under the Obama administration, we had rules around clean water or worker safety or retirement protection, and you would see Republicans asking or in some cases threatening to shut down the government if policy riders weren't put in place that prevented the relevant agency from enacting those regulations. Now, it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting question about why these policy riders are even allowed. And the simple answer is these are bills that fund the government. They provide agency by agency, ultimately, right? So if you look at the guts of an omnibus bill, what you're seeing is the Appropriations Committee saying, we're providing X dollars to this program out of the Department of Labor and Y dollars to this program out of the Department of Justice and so forth. What policy writers do is they say, the Department of Labor cannot use any of that money to do some activity. So, and essentially what it does is it takes the fact that Congress is appropriating money for the agency, that Congress is ultimately controlling the funding stream to an agency, to say, you have money for this program, but it is not acceptable to do the money to use the money to do some particular thing that Congress does not want the agency to do. So what that means is Congress actually can be pretty broad in how it's affecting policy through these spending bills, even when it comes to activities that we typically don't think of as funding or spending issues. And that's why you've seen Democrats, President Obama, and ultimately you continue to see Democrats in Congress put such a hard line against these riders, is because they really create the opportunity for these appropriations bills to have massive impacts on policy beyond just the question of funding the government on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Indra Klein, and she's asking, given the proposed 15% cut in domestic programs that you mentioned, what's the realistic financial impact for programs focused on small businesses? And before I hand it over to you, I'm just going to remind folks that if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad, or you can email that question to us. Go ahead, Jacob. That 15% cut in domestic programs, what is the realistic impact for small businesses?
Sure. So that 15% cut is just as a reminder for FY 2018. So that's not going to be a cut that we would see in the bill that we hope would be passed this week or next week, but it's something that will be under debate as we look at fiscal year 2018, the fiscal year that begins on October 1st. And, you know, I think we can see how that might affect small business in a couple of different ways. The so-called skinny budget did not fully explain where those cuts would all come from, but it gave some indications. It showed, for example, that the president's budget would cut 5% from the SBA, the Small Business Administration, compared to 2017 levels. So right there, you're seeing a 5% cut. It doesn't entirely explain what part of SBA the administration proposes cutting, but obviously that would be a significant cut, and it would be one that doesn't even take into account of inflation. But of course, we see small businesses being affected by much broader parts of the budget than just the SBA. So when you think about potential deep cuts to job training, which provides a stronger workforce, to when you see eliminations of programs that help support economic development like the EDA, all of these things are part of sort of this broader federal ecosystem that helps create the conditions where small businesses can start and grow. And so I think, you know, there are real risks to the SBA, but beyond that, whether you're thinking about job training or research and development that can support innovation, or education funding that help sort of create the basis of a stronger workforce, all of that is at risk when domestic funding is at risk.
Great, thank you. Just one quick clarification question here from Stephen Jimenez in Chicago. He's asking, you mentioned the cost-sharing reduction payments regarding healthcare. Are those the tax credits people get for premiums or something else? And would policies purchased on the SHOP website be affected?
So it's a very good question. These are separate from the tax credits that help families afford coverage. What they are is actually payments that go directly to the insurer, and they essentially make it so what the Affordable Care Act did was require that insurers offering plans on the individual marketplace it requires that they kept deductibles, co-payments, other forms of cost sharing low to make sure that out-of-pocket costs didn't spiral out of control. In order to make it possible for insurers to keep those cost sharing payments low, the Affordable Care Act needed to make the economics work for insurers, and that's where these so-called CSR payments come in. So the CSR payments basically make they make the financial picture work for insurance companies so that they can keep these out-of-pocket payments low without massively increasing premiums for families. And the risk we might see is that without these cost-sharing payments, many insurers might choose to just leave the market. They may decide that the ACA is no longer an attractive program to participate in. And so even though we see right now that in most parts of the country, the ACA is actually working, that while there are ways we could strengthen it, most families who are buying policies on the individual market can get affordable coverage, especially once those premium tax credits kick in. This would really undermine it. I need to confirm this, but my understanding is that CSRs do not apply to plans purchased on the SHOP exchanges, but I actually am not 100% certain about that point. So we can come back and through Business Forward offer clarification on that point.
Great. We will, we'll follow up with you on that point. We have a live question now from Samuel Nixon. Samuel, your line's open. Go ahead and ask your question, and don't forget to introduce yourself with your location and your business.
Yes, my name is Samuel Nixon. My company is Humble One, located here in Alexandria, Virginia. And thank you very much for sharing the information that you have about the impact of potential shutdown and the factors that are involved here. My question is, I'm part of an entrepreneurship group here in the Alexandria area. And as I listen to you and pointing out some of the salient factors, what is the best way for those of us in small businesses and minority businesses to be aware of these particular impacts? And are there resources that we can look at online or otherwise that will kind of summarize some of the points that you've made since there are many factors around the kind of legislative potential kinds of developments that are going on. And since there are a number of subtle points that are involved, because those of us in the small businesses don't always have the clarity and the depth of the issues that you have lifted here, right, which I appreciate very much.
Sure, it's a great question, and I will be honest, we are talking about a set of very complicated issues, and especially on a week like this where we're approaching a deal, it's hard even for those of us who do this for a living to fully keep up. My organization, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, we're at CBPP, that's CBPP.org. We are putting out pretty regular information on the overall fights around the federal budget. So that's one good resource. Honestly, especially when it comes to following the day-to-day, I'd also encourage some of the national outlets, like just frankly following the Washington Post and the New York Times, can be most useful in some of the day-to-day around a potential shutdown, but I think on those broader budget fights, you know, we do a lot of work. Groups like the Center for American Progress do a lot of work talking about potential budget impacts. So those are good places, I think, to go when you're trying to understand, you know, the broad contours of a fight like this.
Great, thanks. Our next question comes from Jim Henderson from Taylor, Michigan, and he's asking, do we have any specifics about how much Republicans will propose for infrastructure spending? Do we have any sense, or do you have any sense of what types of infrastructure they'll target? Are there any significant differences in their approach or priorities across the House, Senate, and the administration?
That's a great question. You know, the president during the campaign and since has said a lot about the need for investing in infrastructure. What he has not done is laid out a particularly specific plan. We hear there's a possibility there might be details that come out tomorrow alongside their tax reform principles that they've promised, but we don't know. During the campaign, the president did lay out an idea for a tax credit for infrastructure, which would essentially provide a subsidy to private developers who want to invest in infrastructure. The downside of that approach is that it only would support infrastructure projects that have a revenue stream. So, for example, it's a model that might work if you want to have a toll road or a toll bridge, because that's money that an investor could recoup, and so therefore a private developer might choose to invest in infrastructure. It's less effective when you talk about building, you know, roads or bridges or transit where there might not be a steady revenue flow. The other downside, of course, is that you might end up providing a lot of the federal money for projects that might occur anyway. And so the big question I think that many of us are watching is, will the administration actually put forward a robust infrastructure program that really includes new spending? What the Obama administration proposed, what the Clinton campaign proposed, for example, what Democrats in Congress have proposed, is even as we look to some public-private partnerships, is a recognition that ultimately, infrastructure is a public investment, and to really make it happen, you do need to spend new dollars, and those dollars have really been in short supply in recent years. And so I think the interesting question is, will the administration propose real new spending, and will Republicans in Congress, who have been deeply opposed to any new spending for infrastructure in recent years, have any willingness to go along with a plan? So what we've seen, unfortunately, today is, I think, quite a bit of rhetoric about the need for new infrastructure, which I think we can agree on a bipartisan basis, but much less in terms of clarity as to what the administration wants to do or, frankly, how they might put forward a robust plan that could actually make it through Congress.
Thanks. We have another live question before we open up the line. Just a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press 1 on your telephone keypad and we'll enter you into the queue, or you can email us questions at info@businessfwd.org. Our next question comes from Stefan Christman. Stefan, your line's open. Go ahead, introduce yourself, please, with your business and where you're calling from.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can.
All right. Hi, my name is Stefan Christman, and I'm calling from Sedona, Arizona. My company is called the Mighty High Chai Tea Company. Let's see. Here in Arizona, it seems as if there's a lot of question on this wall issue. I can't see that it would harm America, and I don't understand why Congress and everybody seems to be fighting about this. They don't seem to be doing anything for the people. I mean, they do, but they don't. And they keep throwing all this rhetoric out there to make us all kind of docile, not, you know, not aware of things. So how in the world can this all come to pass? I don't understand it. How can we get everybody to agree? This makes no sense. Why is everybody getting all mad? There's no reason for this. We need to work together. Why can't we have the wall? I don't understand.
Okay, we'll let Jacob take that. Thank you.
Thanks. I mean, I think, you know, ultimately this comes down to, in my view, a question of priorities. You know, we are seeing, I mentioned some of the deep cuts that are being proposed to domestic spending, and as I described, these are cuts that come at a moment where we already are underfunding many key priorities that, in my view at least, are most important in both strengthening the economy and supporting working families. So ultimately, when we're at a time where Republicans are insisting that any increase in spending gets taken out from something else, the wall just, I think, seems like a pretty problematic priority, and one that is pretty low on the list relative to others. In addition, obviously, I think, you know, many Democrats believe, and certainly this was the position of the Obama administration, that there are much more effective ways to take on the issue of immigration, that there is real economic opportunity in pursuing comprehensive immigration reform. That's an idea that we've seen some bipartisan support for in the past, and would both be a more humane approach as well as one that provides an opportunity for strengthening our economy over the long term. So I think ultimately, when we talk about budgets, we're talking about priorities, and I think there's a, in my view, again, from an economic as well as, frankly, a moral perspective, a case that a wall should not be the highest on the priority list right now compared to other options.
Great. Thank you. We've got a couple questions about the nuts and bolts of the voting. Fred Hunt in Jacksonville, Florida, is asking, what are some of the issues that would keep the most conservative House members from voting for the bill? And as a follow-up to that, is there any indication that some Democrats would support a spending bill, and what compromises might the GOP make to get some of those D votes?
Sure. It's a great question. So I think, first of all, why might conservative Republicans oppose a bill? I think what you see is many of the most conservative Republicans have insisted that we need even deeper spending cuts right now. So I described some of the cuts that are being proposed in FY 2018, which, frankly, many moderate and centrist Republicans, or at least the bulk of their caucus, have already expressed concern about. But you have some Republicans who say, you know, I'm not comfortable with even current spending levels. We need to cut by tens of billions of dollars, and I'm not going to vote for any bill that does that. That's frankly a non-starter for the vast majority of Congress, but you'll see certain conservative Republicans who will use that as effectively a red line that they can't cross, so that they won't be able to vote for anything that doesn't include deep cuts right now. You also see some very conservative Republicans that insist on certain policy riders that can't make it through the rest of Congress. You've seen, for example, an insistence in the past on defunding Planned Parenthood is one example of an area that has been a sticking point for the farthest right members of the Republican caucus, but a place where really there's no way to actually get a bill passed. So those are some of the things that could keep Republicans off board. I think in terms of what gets Democrats on board, I think it's resolving a lot of the issues I mentioned, to be honest. I think many Democrats are quite willing to vote for a bill that doesn't include some of the most problematic ideas like the wall, that doesn't that is consistent with not undermining the ACA and that doesn't have some of the problematic policy riders that we discussed. I think if you could get to a deal, and I think we've seen indications that a deal is not too far away on those big issues, you would see at least a decent number of Democrats willing to go on board. And that would mean, all sorts of much smaller compromises within the bill about, plussing up this program and reducing this program. That's all happening behind the scenes and part of an in-depth negotiation between members of the appropriations committees. So there is a give and take going on. I think the issues that I mentioned are sort of those biggest points that if you could resolve that, everything else would come into place.
Great, thanks. Our next question comes from Joseph Andrews in Boston. And his question is, what's the relationship between appealing the Obamacare tax for high income earners with the capping of payments to the states? In other words, if we kept those taxes, would we be able to resolve any of these likely cuts?
It's a great question. So if I understand correctly what's being asked, one of the biggest issues in the debate over repealing the ACA is whether to get rid of the taxes that helped fund the ACA. And those are taxes that primarily are entirely go to the wealthiest tax, attached to the wealthiest taxpayers, as well as apply to insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies predominantly. And so part of the big debate over the ACA and sort of so-called repeal and replace legislation is Republicans want to undo those taxes. That gets rid of hundreds of billion, over $600 billion in revenue. And in order to do that, they have to cut spending, which is why you have such deep cuts to programs like Medicaid. So the quick answer is, though that debate is not directly part of the question over whether to fund the government, so that's part of the separate debate over repeal and replace legislation. I will say that if there were interest in a bill to strengthen the ACA that did not get rid of all of the revenues that help pay for it, that would obviously be a very different conversation than the one we have right now. So, I think what the question points to is we're in the midst of a really big debate over essentially what we want government to do and what we want our healthcare system to look like. And it turns out that if we undo hundreds of billions of dollars in revenues and do that primarily to the benefit of high-income families, it's a lot harder to have a healthcare system that covers as many people or provides the same level of care. So I think that's a key part of the broader debate, even if it might not be a sticking point in the question over an appropriations bill this week.
Great, thanks. We've got time for a few more questions. The first one is from Teresa Moore in Manchester, New Hampshire. How can they cut mandatory programs, she's asking. You talked about cuts to mandatory programs earlier, like Medicare and Social Security.
Sure. So that would have to happen through a different vehicle, through a different piece of legislation. So the bill that we're talking about this week, right, is an appropriations bill. It can't affect those mandatory programs. The healthcare bill, for example, that has been under debate, does affect mandatory spending. It has significant cuts to Medicaid, which is a mandatory program. So what Congress would need to do to change mandatory spending is draft and pass a bill that does that. And one of the tough things going forward is they may choose to do that through a process called reconciliation, which, without getting deep into it, and I imagine you may have covered this on other calls, is a fast-track process that only requires 50 votes in the Senate. And so what that creates the possibility is that while they're subject to certain rules that limit what they could do, Republicans could look to cut mandatory programs in the future, whether it's as part of a broader package that includes tax cuts or on its own, and I think that's something to watch out for. The first step, though, with all of this is for both congressional Republicans in a budget resolution and for the administration in its budget to just give some clear indication of what they want to do. We still lack a lot of information about what the president, for example, thinks mandatory spending should look like, what he believes spending on programs like Medicaid or even Medicare or Social Security should look like. So I think that's a real thing to watch going forward.
Great, thanks. The next question is, how much does the deficit cost us, and has the increase in interest rates affected the federal spending plans and the budget much?
Sure. So I think, you know, the obviously deficits went down significantly since the beginning of the Obama administration, when a combination of the recession, which significantly reduced the amount of revenue the government was taking in, and some of the measures like the Recovery Act that were necessary to build out of the recession, those increased deficits significantly temporarily. They've now gone down significantly, although obviously we are not at a balanced budget, so we do run some deficits right now. In many ways, the question that you want to look at is, are we running debt levels that are sustainable? And there are a lot of different ways to measure that question. Typically in the Obama administration, we looked at a metric which was debt as a share of the overall economy. So you wanted to say, okay, the issue is not that the government has debt. Lots of governments have debt that can be totally consistent with a healthy economy. But you want to make sure that the debt is not at and is not growing at an unsustainable level. And so when we were putting out our budgets during the Obama administration, that was the metric we would use, is debt as a share of the economy at a sustainable place. And I think, you know, if you had smart budgets going forward, you didn't have large tax cuts that were unpaid for, we could continue to be in that sustainable place. We obviously have some long-term challenges as the population ages in thinking about sort of exactly how much we're spending on major programs. In many ways, I would argue, and my organization, the Center on Budget, put out a paper this week that we could probably be raising more revenue to help fund those programs, and that would be a healthy thing for the economy. But so the question right now really is, do we take steps that keep us on a sustainable path, or do we do potentially irresponsible things that could put our long-term economy at risk by leading debt to go to an unsustainable level? And I think that's a real thing to watch, in particular as we think about some of the debates over tax policy going forward.
Great. Thank you, Jacob, and thanks to all of you for joining us here today. That is all the time we have. We'll be in touch soon about our next digital recording, or excuse me, our next digital event, hopefully a conference call next week. Please check your email for a recording of today's call and a quick survey. We're always trying to improve our programming, so we really appreciate your feedback. So thanks again to Jacob Liebenluck from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities and all of you for your time today. We look forward to working with you again soon.